Here we go. A lot today, so I better be quick. But first of all, quite a few people have asked me in interviews how to do walking meditation. If you don't know already, it's very simple. Doing walking meditation, you start at one end. Put your gaze 2 meters in front of you. Don't look to the left, don't look to the right, up or down. 2 meters in front with your eyes open gives you a sense of safety. You're not going to bump into things, you're not going to step on things. About 2 meters. You don't need to get a tape measure, measure it out 2 meters, just roughly. You know, that amount of distance. So you can just see in front of you, see where you're going. And first thing, try and just be in the moment. Don't waste the time just thinking about where you're going to go next, where you came from, the problems of your life, contemplating the meaning of life. You're just walking. Keep it nice and simple. Present moment. And just feel the feet as they're moving. Just as you lift the foot up, you can feel all the muscles which are necessary just to lift the foot, and you move it forward, and you just find out what part of the foot touches the ground first and how it feels with your skin just on the carpet or on the floor. Just feel it all. It's nice if you do the walking meditation to take socks off, so do it with your bare foot because you're more sensitive. And you really get to be aware of just the feelings involved in walking. You focus on that. You get to the end, you turn around and come back again. So the focus of the attention should really be on the feelings in the feet and the lower legs as you're doing the walking. And it makes you very, very peaceful. You say, don't worry about anyone else who's walking past you or walking next to you. Just get in your own little bubble and you just focus on the feet moving. If you want to, you can just say some mantras as you're lifting your foot, moving it forward, putting it down, just to begin with. Those mantras are great just to get you focused. But once you really get into it, just let all the words disappear. I'll say more about that tomorrow, but that was just, I had to say that very quickly. Before people walk and they don't know what they're doing. And also, last night I did promise you, whoever wrote the question, can you please give the precise sutta reference for the 2 monks meditating, one nodding the other, sitting upright. It's in 2 places, in the Anguttara Nikaya. So the references are here if you want to pick it up later on. So, that's business all done. Here we go. Can you please slow down in your delivery of Q&A, please? Well, you're going to go to bed very late tonight. Is masturbation making bad karma? That's an interesting one for a nice evening's talk. You're not breaking your 8 precepts or whatever. You're supposed to have no sex at all. What it is, it's not so much bad karma, but instead of actually getting into sort of your bodily pleasure, you get into the mental pleasures instead. So it's not really bad karma, but it doesn't really help the meditation. Why Mahamoggallana made a vow to serve the future Buddha, Gautama, he was a disciple of the previous Buddha, and renounces his own enlightenment at the time. He did not do that. That is some commentary idea which doesn't make any sense. That's Gomaya. Once you become enlightened, it's not up to you anymore. We always think we're in control. That's only when one doesn't really understand this, what will is and what the mind is. Later on, I will start discussing with you the nature of the human will, and you will find out in your practice of meditation, this thing which you assume to be your will, which controls things, it's not your will after all. There's not a person behind deciding what to do. It's a process. And it's just part of nature. Once one becomes enlightened, just the world is just about gone. You've got no choice anymore. You have to leave. You can't make any vow to serve future Buddhas or whatnot. So that's written in commentaries. People didn't understand what enlightenment really was. But if you don't agree with me there, wait for a couple of days, and when I start talking about insight and especially anatta, you'll understand what I mean. Dear Ajahn Brahm, when you lower your expectation from other people, it helps to keep the happiness. Yes, that's what I said. However, That is a terrible one. However and but. I know I'm in trouble. However, when you run an organization like this and be a leader, how do you keep the discipline and the proper functioning of the organization? What do you do to the people who don't obey rules? Do you ever give punishments if someone goes below the minimum standard? How do you see that? It is sometimes that I get invited to give talks to corporations on leadership. And part of that is to, I gave talks to Facebook and Google. That's in the headquarters in Silicon Valley. And I always like quoting from the Chinese Art of War, the general who had the best discipline in the Imperial Army. The soldiers would always follow his orders. And when the emperor heard about this, he wanted to learn from this general how to have such perfect discipline. Because the emperor also had to have that authority to get his ministers and other people follow his commands. And so he summoned the emperor to the court, and so he summoned the general to the court and asked the general, how come you have such good discipline amongst your soldiers? And the general said, sire, my soldiers always follow my orders because I only ever tell them to do what they want to do. That's why they never disobey me. Now, that is perfect discipline. So if you only tell the workers in your company to do what they want to do, of course they will follow orders. But at first you think that's a stupid answer. How can soldiers want to get up early in the morning? How can they want to train hard? How can they want to go into battle knowing that there's a good chance they'd be killed or wounded, even maimed? And the answer is, obviously, motivation. Discipline, the best discipline, is caused by motivation. That general was such a great motivator. It was his talks, his instructions, his example was so inspiring that every soldier under his command, they wanted to get up in the morning. They couldn't wait for the bell to go to get up. They couldn't wait to train. They couldn't wait to go and fight for their emperor, to be patriotic, to serve their country, whatever it was that general said, that they wanted to go into battle. That's why they always followed orders. It's motivation is the cause for great discipline. So don't try and use your force and use fear, because that's what punishment does. If you're running a company and you try and discipline or run that company through fear, it works as long as you're in the building. But as soon as you come to Jhana Grove to do a retreat, who knows what your workers are doing in your company? So that's why punishment does not work. All that punishment does, it makes your workers more sneaky to get away with things without getting caught. So, it's motivation. So a person feels the reason why they need to get up early, why they need to meditate, why they need to keep the rules and precepts. And that's one of the things which is missing in our way of doing things, in governments and also in corporations. Why keep the rules when you're not motivated to do so? If you realize, for example, our Buddhist society, people are so highly motivated. They're doing something inspiring. Now they're serving the Dhamma. They're making this retreat available for people. All these talks on the internet, they're helping thousands of people. And people give their time for no money at all to do this sort of stuff. It's incredible what they're doing. And do you need to force people to do that? No, you inspire them. And thereby you get the best discipline of all. So this is how we lower expectations and we motivate and inspire ourselves and others. And when you inspire and motivate your children, the children just want to go to work.
That's how we do things. And it's really interesting that when you hire a person to do some work, or you get a volunteer to do the work, the volunteer usually does a much better job because they're doing it for love, they care. If you pay them, they try and get the most money for the least work. But if it's actually, no, not all people, because Dimi is our admin officer, so we pay her, but she does extra work because you're inspired and motivated. So that is actually how to get people to really have good discipline, inspiration. Get discipline for you guys to get up early in the morning and to meditate. If we punished you for not getting for the morning chanting, what would happen? Would that be a nice retreat? No, you inspire people. Getting up early in the morning, the best time of the day. And also, I don't know why this is, but it is tradition that most people get enlightened at dawn. So the earlier you get up, the more dawns you make it to this place, you're increasing your chances of becoming enlightened. If you're always sleeping in past the first light, you've got no hope. So that's called inspiration. Now you want to get up, it's good fun. Next question, what is perception, memory and perception, sanya? This includes various thoughts and concepts. Now, sometimes when we have these ideas in Buddhism, especially when we start giving the Pali names for these things, sometimes people try and make it just so precise. But the Buddha used the language in the normal way it is used, imprecise. The people the Buddha talked to were not lawyers. They were ordinary farmers and ordinary people. And so much of the time, the words the Buddha used were used quite loosely, not so precisely. Now, it wasn't sort of a philosopher or a lawyer or an engineer which uses words just so, like with so much jargon. It was just to ordinary people. So sometimes people use perception, and sometimes it was the same as consciousness, and sometimes it was the same as mind. So you can actually see, and for example, Potapada Sutta, they use perception the same as consciousness. But if you look at the broad picture, it just means it's part of whenever you're conscious of something, you perceive it. So it's just an aspect of consciousness. And in particular, if you want to be more precise, the way the Buddha and most people usually use it is that when you hear something, see something, smell, taste, touch, or experience it, now we perceive it, which is a filtering process which happens subconsciously. We don't see this happening to the point that eventually we hear what we want to hear. We see what we want to see. Our perception is often untrustworthy. And at the conference we held last August, we had one of my friends, he was at Cambridge together, and he, you know, both studied theoretical physics, both were in the Psychic Research Society, hunting ghosts and all sorts of other weird stuff, and both were Buddhists. So we just did the same things. So that's why we became close friends. I left theoretical physics to follow my Buddhism, became a student of Ajahn Chah. He stayed as a theoretical physicist and became a student of Stephen Hawking. That was his teacher. And he kept his interest, obviously, in Buddhism and psychic research. And he told us this wonderful experiment which was done in Imperial College in London. And in this experiment, the professor, who was a physicist but also into psychic research, he put a flower pot, it's a big, you know, the lecture table, in the lecture theatre. He moved a flower pot into the center of the table. And in front of not students, but, you know, professors, faculty members, he said, "We are now going to levitate this flower pot." And of course, that is impossible according to science. And people thought this guy was crazy. But, you know, see what happens. And he said, to create the right atmosphere, I want your help. I want you all to chant Om. So that all these crusty old professors of physics and astronomy, all there going Om. And as they were going Om, he also asked them to concentrate. And my goodness, the flower pot levitated in front of everybody. It worked. And there's no strings there, no cables anywhere. It actually levitated above the table. And the reason it levitated, but the professors and the audience didn't know this, there was this huge electromagnet under the table. The ohm was to hide the hum of the current. So very well designed. But that was not the point. The point was it actually levitated, lifted up. And many of those professors could not see it. Afterwards, they no, there was no levitation. It didn't rise up above the table. It just sat there all the time. Even though it actually levitated, recorded on camera, other people see it. Some people just could not see it. It was a great example of how, yes, the thing rose up the table, that light showing it was rising up the table came into their eyes, but by the time they perceived it, they filtered it out. This can't happen. So they didn't see it. It was a great experiment how, when the evidence before your eyes to trained senior scientists, when it goes against your fundamental worldviews, you block it out. You only see what you want to see. You cannot see what is too shocking for you. And that was an extreme case of how perception is untrustworthy. What you see, what you hear, is not what I said. You filter it. And that's why we get so many different religions, so many different arguments. It's, well, I saw it, I heard it. Yes, so did I saw it and heard it. But what you saw and heard was out there, but by the time it gets into your brain, you've messed around with it. That is why perception is very, very dangerous. So how can we trust perception? The Buddha actually pointed out a very brilliant teaching. He said, they call it the five hindrances. The five hindrances are what bend perception, distort it. And those five hindrances, if you don't know already, is desire or aversion. Desire, you see what you want to see. Aversion, you block out in denial to actually see what's there if it's really you don't want to see it. Restlessness, which is, you know, you're not still enough to really see things. Sloth and torpor, just too dull. And doubt, it can't be happening. Those are the things which block seeing things as they truly are. So if you want to do insight practice, if you want to trust your perceptions, you have to first of all subdue the five hindrances. No desire, no ill will. So you're not going to bend the truth to suit you. Whatever's there, you see. No restlessness, you are still. No sloth and torpor, you are clear. No doubts, you suspend those. That's the job of meditation. By the deep meditations, that is how the five hindrances are suppressed. So that's what you're doing here. So by becoming still, overcoming the sloth and torpor, increasing your mindfulness, you are preparing your mind to see things as they truly are. And sometimes it's quite shocking. It's not what you expect, but it's truthful. It's one of the reasons people aren't enlightened, because they don't want to be. So anyway, that's perception. And the distortion of perception, the Pali word is called Sanya Vipalasa. Brilliant little teaching of the Buddha, the distortions of perception. How do I get out of a meditation gently rather than feeling crash-landed? great question. If you really get into a deep meditation, please come out very, very, very slowly. I always remember Lynn, our caretaker at Nolamara. I really, really praised her this time because there was one guy in a Saturday afternoon meditation. After I rang the bell, he was still sitting there. After I talked to people, he was still sitting there. I could see he just got into a really, really deep meditation. And this lady, Lynn, was just so sensitive, she just sat in the back and waited for him to come out. And then very gently lifted him up and took him to one of the side rooms in the dark so he could come out very slowly. I thought, wow, Lynn, you've been listening to these teachings, and that was emotionally so sensitive and the right thing at the right time. So he got into really deep meditation. If you get into really deep meditation, just sit there. First of all, open your eyes, first of all, but don't move. Just keep the eyes open, just to get the senses working again. And then, just don't go outside, just go and do a little bit of walking to get the body moving again. Do it very slowly and gently. Ajahn Chah used to say, it's like pouring hot water in a cool glass. You don't really damage yourself, it can be so jarring sometimes. So do it very gently. Open your eyes, but carry on sitting. Don't move, but sit there with your eyes open. And then very slowly get up. Feel all the muscles moving as you get up. And go and do some walking meditation. And do a walking meditation for a while, and then you can go outside. Do it gently. Especially if you go to the really nice deep meditations. Dear Venerable Ajahn, to get to the level of Sotapanna, one has to get rid of the three fetters or bondages. That is Sakkaya Ditti, which is self-view, Vichikicca, which is doubt, and Silabbata Paramasa, which is the view, the belief that you can get enlightened just by doing some chanting or some practices. They gave an example of that. There was the first two people the Buddha met in the suttas. One was doing the cow practice, the other one was doing the dog practice. And the cow practice, which would go around on all fours eating grass, going moo. And if anyone has been to India, sometimes you see those people today, doing really strange things. Probably they don't do it these days, but they used to do it when I went to India. And so this cow ascetic went around hanging out with other cows, eating grass. I don't know how he survived. And he went to the Buddha one day, and he stopped his mooing for a little while and just asked the Buddha, I've done this cow practice for a long time. Will I get enlightened or will I go to a heavenly state? Because it's very hard to do. It takes a lot of effort and restraint to do that. And the Buddha said, don't ask me. No, please, I want to know. No, don't ask me. Please, well look, if you carry on like this, in your next life you get reborn as a cow. It's obvious. You'd end up in McDonald's, probably. But, that was an example of what it meant. Sometimes people do these really weird practices, thinking that that's going to make them enlightened. So anyway, are the doings like Bodhi Puja, lighting lamps and incense, and keeping food and water in front of the Buddha statues belong to this category of Silabbata Paramasa? It really depends why you do those practices, like chanting or like bowing. Now, first of all, the chanting. This is obviously a Sri Lankan person who wrote this. Please excuse me, I'm not just banging Sri Lankan tradition. They do stupid things in all the traditions. One of those ones is the all-night period chanting, where you get sort of monks in to chant for about 12 hours. And it's not the normal chanting. It's really distorted chanting. And number one, it really, really makes the monks very, very tired doing stuff like that. I think Bhante Ji, Gunaratna, once had to do that. And he had a sore throat for days afterwards. And people think that because your parents did that and your grandparents did that, it must be right. So don't just follow tradition. Follow actually what you look for in the Buddhist teachings. Did the Buddha ever do all-night period chanting? No way. So some of that stuff, it goes a bit too far. It's harmful. And in that case, we can give it away. putting food and water in front of the Buddha, what are you doing that for? If it really is devotion, this is a gift to the Buddha, out of respect for the Buddha, fine, that's paying respect. Or putting candles and incense. But if ever you look at how the Buddha taught, the Buddha said, this is in Mahaparinibbana Sutra, if you really want to pay respect to a Buddha, you don't do it by offering incense or flowers or candles or lighting lamps. So the only way to pay respect to a Buddha is by following his example, carrying out his teachings. That is the greatest way you can pay respect. The greatest way, you know, in Asian tradition, to pay respect to your parents is actually to do things which will inspire your parents, make your parents so happy that you are a good person, following their example, good examples, instructions, and being a good child. That inspires them. And even myself as a teacher these days, you please don't give me any gifts. I'm trying to live a very simple life. The best way you can show your thanks to me is actually getting into jhanas, getting enlightened and coming to tell me. That makes me just so happy. As it would, you know, if your child, you know, does something really wonderful, they pass their degree, that makes parents so proud and happy. So that is the way we pay respect. Yeah, you can put the candles and incense on there, but we don't do any incense anymore. I remember going to see the chief pathologist. We used to go to autopsies when we first came here. And I happened to ask him, he said, smoking cigarettes or inhaling incense smoke, is there any difference? And he said, no, smoke is smoke is smoke. It's dangerous for you. And that's why no incense here. And very rarely we have any incense in Bodhinyana. It's the same health effects of smoking cigarettes. So some of these temples, so smoky, it's bad for your health. So stop doing it. So those are some of the reasons why we try and keep it as simple as possible. And that's actually become, but please be careful of wanting to become a stream winner. This story I like telling, a great story. I don't know why I have to be in Sri Lanka again. Please, these things happen in Thailand as well, just stupid things. Like in Thailand, they like making lots of Buddha statues. Thousands of Buddha, we've got too many Buddha statues. But still they like doing that. Or in the Chinese temples. If you ever go to the Chinese temple, you'll see people going in there, taking the incense and shaking it before they put it in the pot. And I've often asked people, why do you do that? And no one could ever tell me. So that's what we do. So I use my own insight to find out why people shake the incense when they go to Chinese temples. And it's because I've been a Buddhist monk a long time. I stayed in many temples and I've seen what happens. In Sri Lanka, in Thailand, in Hong Kong, Malaysia, Singapore, you get taken to the temple for the first time by your grandmother. I don't know why, not the grandfather, the grandma usually takes you to the temple and shows you what to do. So grandma takes her shoes off, you take your shoes off. Grandma comes into the temple and bows, you bow. Grandma takes the incense and lights it, and grandma shakes the incense because she's got Parkinson's. And the grandchildren, they do the same. And now it's gone down generation after generation, everybody shakes the incense. That's what, crazy stuff. So that's why sometimes we, and anyway, this thing in Sri Lanka, there was people, I was told this, actually when I was going to San Francisco, was it almost a year ago, just on 11 months ago, to go and give a talk at Google, and they told me that there was this group in Colombo who had like a retreat like we do here, but a bit longer, 2 or 3 weeks, and it was meditation and also instructions. At the end of the retreat, they gave people a written test and also an interview. And on the basis of, you know, what you did in your meditation and how you answered the questions, if you did very well, they would declare that you were a stream winner, or a once returner, or a non-returner, or sometimes even four arahats. They gave you a certificate afterwards. And it became really, really popular. And it happened that there was one old lady came from one of the remote areas of Sri Lanka to visit her relations in Colombo. And she was a devout Buddhist, who would always go to the temple, and her relations decided to give her a treat, to sponsor her on this special retreat. They'd pay so she could go there and meditate and study. And so at the end of that 3 or 4 weeks, she did the test, and they came up to her afterwards with big smiles on their face, saying, "Grandmother, Auntie, you've done really, really well. We're proud, having assessed what you've written and your meditation, we're proud to say that you are now a stream winner, a sowan." And they presented her with certificates. And this old lady got very upset and angry and started scolding, you know, the people in charge. And they could not understand why. Why are you scolding us? You're a stream winner. You're one of the enlightened ones. People will want to become stream winners. Why are you scolding us? And she looked at them and said, "You don't remember me, do you? I was here last year and you said I was a non-returner. You've demoted me." And stories like that meant the whole organization was shut down. Scams. So you don't get certificates for these things. Anyway, but people want these things so much that some scallywags go on and sort of promise you certificates and people believe it. Anyone, did Lord Buddha specify that nuns and monks should stay in the same compound or should not stay in the same compound? He actually specified they should not stay in the same compound, that we should have separate monasteries for them. Maybe we can come and visit and stay in a retreat center, but not really stay there regularly. And if you want to know the reason why, I told this in my speech at Dharmasara opening just over a week ago. You know, why go to all this trouble making a big monastery for the bhikkhunis all over in Dharmasara? And because people, ordinary Australians, when they think that monks and nuns are staying in the same compound, what do they think? Just like my father would tell me when I was a young boy, one of his jokes was, "What fun does a monk have?" Answer, "None." That is not true. We're very good monks. But the point is, if you have like celibate men and celibate women in the same compound, even if they are really good monks and really good nuns keeping our precepts, people will always doubt. Even honest, where the builders who built this place, one of the monks overheard them speaking, "These monks, they don't have any wives." He said, "But on the weekends they invite the prostitutes in." That's what these Australian builders were saying over there. And this is, now, of course, you know Australian builders, ordinary people, they would always doubt. That's why it's not that you just have to be celibate. You have to be seen to be celibate, because people would always be doubting you. So that is why monks in one place, nuns in the other. And the other reason, which is also important, every place I've seen where monks and nuns have been in the same compound, the monks have always ruled the roost. They are the ones who eventually sort of take control and take power. It's no independence. So that was also one reason, I've said this before, a long time before you nuns came here, when we chose a place, you know, for Dharmasara Nuns Monastery, I wanted to be far away from this monastery on purpose. So just not even proximity would mean that no, I would be influencing them at all. Far away so you can have independence. So otherwise, if the monks and nuns are too close together, it just happens too often the monks end up sort of controlling the place. Even if there's many more nuns there, still the monks end up just being the boss. So that's why, you know, we try and keep it separate, so that you are the boss in your place. So this is nice. Dear Ajahn, why anger is from past karma, and is it right if Buddha teaching only exists 5,000 years? Okay, what is anger? Why is anger from past karma? It's because of stupidity. Because, now this is the old story, and when you think about this, and think about it and reflect upon it again and again and again, it makes you let go of getting angry at what someone did to you. A lot of times it wasn't your past karma, it was somebody else's. They cheated you, they let you down, they even abused you. You didn't do anything wrong, you were the victim. But you still carry that suffering years and years afterwards. When you look at it that way, it makes no sense. They did the hurtful thing. Why do you have to suffer? And you can see what happens. In brief, someone calls you an idiot. What happens? You think, they call me an idiot. They've got no right to call me an idiot. They shouldn't call me an idiot. And if you're wise, you realize they've just called you an idiot 3 more times. Every time you remember it, you allow them to hurt you again. Your partner sort of cheated on you. They slept with one of your best friends. They hurt you. But every time you remember it, with anger, they are hurting you again. They're cheating you again. After a while, you realize that that reaction is not the right way to deal with these things. Only allow people to hurt you once. Then let it go. It's not called forgiveness. You've got no power to absolve them of their bad karma. They'll catch it in the end. But you don't need to share their bad karma. You did nothing. It was their fault. They called you an idiot. Stupid thing to say. I am not going to remember that. They cheated you. Why should you keep remembering it? They hurt you, they let you down. You didn't do anything wrong, so you should let it go. Because we don't know how to let go. We carry suffering which doesn't belong to us. That is stupid. Here, when you meditate, you start to learn how to let these things go. So the past bad karma, you can just dispose of. And is it right if the Buddha's teaching only exists 5,000 years? Again, that is a lot of Gomayang. There's many places in the suttas, you can look at it and compare it to other teachings in the suttas, and some teachings don't fit. And one of those is when the Buddha allowed the ordination of bhikkhunis, it is said there that once we allow bhikkhunis to ordain, the teachings will only last 500 years. Not 5,000, 500. Panchasatta. 500 years. People say 5,000. I don't know where they get that 5,000 from. It does not say that. Don't be panchasahasi. This is panchasatta. 500 years. So if the Buddha actually said that, number one, he was wrong. Because Buddhism is now 2,500 years at least since that time, it's still going on. So if the Buddha did say that, he obviously made a mistake. And number two, the Buddha never did predictions. That was totally out of character. The only time he would sort of do a prediction is if you do a good work, then happiness is going to come. If you practice the Eightfold Path, you'll get to Nibbana. Those sorts of general predictions, now that is in line with how the Buddha would teach. But giving specific instructions or predictions, in 500 years this is going to happen, in 100 years that's going to happen, nowhere else did the Buddha say that. Which is why many scholars and intelligent Buddhists, monks, nuns, look at that and said, that is so out of character, the Buddha could never have said that. number one, it's wrong. Buddha made a mistake. So that's pretty off. And number two, it's out of character. But who cares what the Buddha said there? Buddhism is still going strong. It's way over 500 years. The understanding is not me, mine, and how can you understand Dhamma, the path, at all? You don't understand it. Understanding arises in the mind, but you don't own it. Yeah, there is no me, no mine, not a self, but you have happiness, you have suffering. Suffering arises, suffering passes away, so you understand how it all works. The wood is not me, mine, then how can we let go of it? That is a much better question. You cannot let go of the will. Someone else has to do it for you. You get brainwashed. And the brainwasher today is me. But where did I get brainwashed? From Ajahn Chah. Where did Ajahn Chah get his brainwashing from? From his teacher, Ajahn Mun. Where did he get it from? Back. It goes down to the Buddha, the first brainwasher. But where did the Buddha get brainwashed from? From the previous Buddha, Kassapa. Goes round and round and round. Without what they call the hearing, the teachings of another enlightened person, an Aryan, you cannot become enlightened. That's said in the suttas. You need the teachings of another enlightened person for you to become enlightened. Another enlightened person has to put the seed in, has to brainwash you, because your will can't stop your will. So that's what happens. So the Buddha can't do it himself. He did need to get that previous understanding from Kassapa. So that was a very good question. Could you elaborate on how we can diminish our ignorance in daily life? Listen to my talks on YouTube. Meditate. Suppress the hindrances, and then your delusion gets lessened. Why is it that some of us are finding it difficult to be mindful of the breath, in spite of you giving detailed, profound guidance? Is it bad past karma? Because you're not following my guidance. Have I told you to start watching the breath yet? Deliberately I said, don't do that. Just relax the body, and next step is to get a peaceful mind. You're rushing ahead of yourselves. You're too impatient. Slow down. You asked me to slow down in the questions and answers, and you're not slowing down yourself. So it's true, you're trying to watch the breath too soon. You're not ready yet. So go back to the instructions. You know, it's like people have a new computer or a microwave, and they plug it in first, take it outside the box, plug it in, and it blows up or something goes wrong. It's only then that they read the instructions. You know what the instructions are there for? To read first and then follow. So please read the instructions first of all. Otherwise your warranty on this retreat is voided. So if you follow the instructions, it becomes very easy to watch the breath. So its instructions are there, but you haven't really paid attention. How do we identify when the mind is starting to settle? Please explain a little bit about this situation. You are mindful of this thing, the settling of the mind, the peace of the mind. The more you start to become noticing that, focusing on that, the more aware you become of what I mean by that. It's the same way, remember I said about that monk who had to learn to be mindful of the muscles on either side of his spine. How did he manage to do that? It took weeks of training, months of training. So he could be aware of those muscles. In the same way, it takes a lot of training for you to become aware of that part of your mind which is showing you how peaceful you are or how agitated you are. It takes a while before you can see that. But once you start focusing on it and start to become sensitive to that indicator in your mind, then you're really away in your meditation. You can feel it. It's settling or it's not settled. It's peaceful or it's agitated. You can see that straight away. And because you can see that, how agitated, how settled your mind is, you know when it's settled, you know how to make it more settled, really deeply settled, profoundly settled, incredibly settled. You can take that all the way into the deepest of meditations. So this is actually, you're mindful of that. Then actually that's how you know. Mindfulness is great, but you've got to be mindful of the right thing. You can be mindful of all sorts of things. That's why these scallywags in some places, they used to say, you can have sex, you can masturbate as long as you're mindful. And that's practicing the path. They're missing a point there. It's not just mindfulness, it's all the other factors of the Eightfold Path. And are you really mindful of the right thing? Are you mindful if you're having sex or you're masturbating on how peaceful you are, how settled you are, or how agitated you are? If you could see that thing, then you'd understand the answer to the question which I gave at the beginning. Can we have guided meditation wherein you can give instructions for a few minutes and then we can continue at 6 a.m. to sit? The reason we don't give guided meditation is because some people like it, some people don't like it. Some people just like to sit quietly and they have to endure the guided meditation. To find a balance for that, many of you have brought your iPhones with you. You can download the guided meditation talks. So you can have those on your smartphones. So and there's plenty there by me and many other teachers. You can find your favorite ones. They're very helpful. And once you have them on your iPhone, you can put, you know, sitting here in your room, anywhere else, put in your earplugs, and you have your own guided meditation when you want it, and it doesn't disturb anybody else. It is a useful thing to have. So I'm going to use that technology, but don't just put, you know, songs on your iPhone. Just put these guided meditations. They're all for free. And then you can listen to them whenever you want. So you're here on a retreat, earplugs, and do the guided meditation whenever you think you need it. And then once you've done that, you can just turn it off, carry on meditating, which means you have guided meditation at any time you want. When you come to meditation hall, I feel so comfortable. When I come in, okay, maybe I can leave my photo here. I can leave a dummy, get Madame Tussauds to do some dummy of me. But it is important that sometimes that people just, you know, they do in, if you have a really angry person comes into this hall, you can feel them straight away. There's a very angry person in here. But a peaceful person comes in here, you can feel that peace as well. My question is, why do people see different color nimitters? The colors are just totally insignificant. Whatever color it is, when these lights come into your mind, is not important. Sometimes the colors are just because it's your favorite color or a color you just saw a little while ago or what you believe to be. It's a perception. It's not important. What is important is how deep that color is, how beautiful it is. But I'll say more on that when I get to the nimitta talk later on. Is insight impermanent too? And can you explain again about anicca vanish? Please, at my understanding, it is same with when we hear sound and that sound arising and passing away. Or anicca vanishes nibbana. Thank you. Okay, is insight impermanent too? Of course it's impermanent. It's like the Buddha said, unfortunately they used to cut people's hands and feet off in those days, in ancient days, as punishments. And they use that as a simile. If someone has had their hands and feet cut off, would they always have that knowledge they had their hands and feet cut off? No, not if they were just, you know, watching some dancing. They forget about that. But it would always be there for them whenever they paid attention to it. The Buddha said the same as insight. It's always there for you when you pay attention to it, but it's not always present. there for you. But when it comes to anicca, again, it's... I'm going to leave the... There's a lot of other questions in here. My favourite simile of this, the tadpole and the frog later on. But it's like you're sitting by the lake. You see the waves come and go. Anybody can see that. That's not going to make you enlightened. That's obvious. To get enlightened, you have to see things which you haven't seen before, which shock you. And that is when you're sitting by the lake, not just the waves go up and down, the whole lake vanishes. It's not there anymore. Now that is interesting. It's not supposed to happen. Then you realize it's not, for many people, anicca is just, yes, stuff, senses, consciousness, yeah, it comes and goes, but to see consciousness itself vanish, to see will totally disappear, see your five senses not there anymore, things which have always been there, which you've taken for granted as permanent, but you haven't seen them, when they vanish, now you get shocked. But I'll go on to that in more detail, because there's lots to do here, and I have to speak slowly. That's why it's taken so long tonight. So, again, the anicca and anatta in the talk and insight later on this week, I'll go into more detail. Most seats of science that they have been claimed for use by an individual, i.e. cushions, clothing, etc. Could you please clarify if seats are meant to be allocated to individuals or free for all? Here we believe in no self. There is no one here. No me, no mine, no self. So who can own one of these seats? So it's first come, first serve. Whoever gets up here first thing in the morning, you can have that seat for the day. But if you sleep in, you may lose your seat. So you can sit anywhere. You're even allowed to sit up here. But if you do sit up here, you will have your head shaved and ordained, and you'll have to become a monk afterwards. Or if you sit over there, you have to become a nun. So you can sit anywhere. And if you sit here, you will have to give the talk tomorrow morning. But it's not nice to reserve seats, but sometimes people get into a seat, they feel comfortable there. And they know where to come. They don't have to look around. So it's not really reserved, but you know, you've got your seat now. You've got used to where you sit, and so it's comfortable. So it's not really reserved, but you know, just be kind to one another and let them sit where they like to sit. What is the most skillful way to deal with wandering thoughts? Let them wander. I find constant noting awareness of them leads to boredom. Exactly. The classic story. There was a woman here in Perth, had a 6-year-old son, who one day got so upset with his mother that he told his mum, "I don't love you anymore, I'm leaving home." And this wonderful mother said, "Okay, darling, I will help you pack." And so they went to the bedroom and they packed the most important stuff, the Spider-Man suit, the teddy bear, all the important stuff if you're going to leave the world at 6 years of age. And before he left, the mother said, "Before you go, I'll make you something for lunch, because life is a long time." So I made a favorite sandwich, peanut butter and jam or something, put it in a little paper bag, and the two of them went to the front door of the house. And the mother waved her son off, "Bye-bye, darling, don't forget to write." And there the little boy with a little suitcase in one hand and a brown paper bag with a sandwich in the other left home for the first time. Walked to the end of the garden path, opened the gate and turned left and walked off into his life. He only got about 50 meters when he started to get homesick. He's only 6. He turned around, got through the garden gate, walked up the path, the mother hadn't moved. "Welcome home, darling." Now that was emotional intelligence. She knew especially when she was so kind as to help pack the bags and giving him his favorite sandwich. She knew the son would come back if she let him go. Because it was a home, was a nice place. Mum's there, the favorite bed, everything is there. What kid in the right mind would leave home? That is like the wandering mind. Your mind is saying, you don't love me anymore, I'm leaving, I'm out of here. And it wanders off. Let it wander off. Bye-bye, mine, have a nice time. Don't forget to write. And if you really are kind, not punishing your mind, being kind to it, your mind will come back. Wow, she actually really respects me. She loves me. Why would I want to wander off? The only reason the mind wanders off is because you haven't been kind to it. It's trying to escape from you. I've noticed that the ants have created cities and highways in the forest. Of course, they live here too. Are we humans replicating the wrong species of animals? Ants? Yes, of course, because who are you anyway? You're retreat ants. Retreatants. Retreat ants? Oh, come on. I really try hard to make new jokes. But you've got to encourage me by laughing. Retreat ants. You're ants too. Retreatants. Oh, crikey. Is it a must to attain jhana for enlightenment? Yep. That's an easy question. Sorry, but it's a must. And that's actually in the suttas. At SM 1270, that means Sanyutta Nikaya, SN, not SM. I imagine Venerable Sutta, the Susima Sutta. What's meant by dry insight? Is it without jhanas? It never says dry insight anywhere in the suttas. In the Susima Sutta, all it says is the two types of enlightenment. Enlightenment with the jhanas and enlightenment without the arupa attainments, which are the after the four jhanas. And it's incredible, people, again, see what they want to see as an excuse for not having to get jhanas. The Buddha taught eightfold path is the only way to get enlightened. Eightfold path, number eight is samma samadhi. Right stillness, and right stillness is always explained, maybe, I haven't counted, 200, 300, 400 times, consistently, first jhana, second jhana, third jhana, fourth jhana. There's no such thing as dry insight. And in the Susima Sutta, it doesn't say that it's enlightenment without the jhanas. Two types of enlightenment is the enlightenment with the jhanas, number two, jhanas and the immaterial attainments. That's what it says. So if you want to get it out, I can show it to you. It would be nice if we had meditation villages based on similar concept as retirement villages in cities. Is it possible to visit your cave, Ajahn Brahm? You want to visit my cave? You can. My cave is not in Bodhinyana Monastery. My cave is in stillness, in silence. That cave you're allowed to visit. The other cave over in Bodhinyana is just a bunch of rocks. What do you want to visit that for? It's crazy. People just like to visit weird places. Sometimes people want to go and see the Great Wall of China. If you haven't seen the Great Wall of China yet, just go to Bodhinyana Monastery. You've got a wall there. That's the same. Just one is a bit bigger than the other, but it's a wall. No difference, really. If you want to see Niagara Falls, just look at all the rain falling down the car park yesterday. That was like Niagara Falls. If that doesn't satisfy you, go under the shower. Water falling, all the same. You want to see the Grand Canyon, just look at all the erosion from that rain the other day. That's the Grand Canyon just down the road over here. Well, why do you want to go see my cave for? Crazy people. But people always like going to see the four holy places. The four holy places of Buddha. Even actually the Buddha encouraged people to go on pilgrimage to the four holy places where the Buddha lived. What are those four holy places? Anyone know the first one? Oh, you're dropping my fun. People think the four holy places are Lumbini, where the Buddha was born, Bodh Gaya, where he was enlightened, Sarnath, where he gave his first teaching, and Kusinara, where he passed away. But those are the four real holy places. That's just the Buddha's body, the Buddha's mind. Where does the Buddha's mind live? Those are the four jhanas. So the four real holy places, to find out what it feels like to be a Buddha. First jhana, second jhana, third jhana, fourth jhana. Then you never need to go to India. And you get far more inspired and far closer to the Buddha. So that's the places to visit. And where do you do that? In Ajahn Brahm's Jhana Grove Travel Agency. Just here. And meditation villages, again, first jhana, second jhana, third jhana, fourth jhana. That's the meditation village. My biggest hindrance to meditation is self-consciousness. In a big place like this, how do I overcome this using Buddhist teachings? There is no self. I like little jokes sometimes, and somebody from a Buddhist magazine, they had this meditation center, just like this place. And they had the lunch, a buffet, just like here. But in this meditation, they had two lines. Two different buffets. One was for the enlightened ones, no self service, and the other unenlightened ones, self service. Two different lines. So enlightened ones went to the no self service counter, and the other ones went to the self service. I thought that was quite cool. But anyway, so self consciousness. What you're saying is, I'm worried what other people think of me. Look, you can look at someone like me, dressed like this. When I used to go to England, it happened once. I was visiting some relations in Stoke-on-Trent. On a Sunday morning, we went for a nice walk. You know, beautiful, I said winter time, but it was a beautiful summer day. And when I was going for a walk in my robes, people were pointing at me and laughing. Ha ha ha, look at him, ha ha ha. You know, I never had that before. You know, people, you know, give you, you know, the finger and other stuff, and call you Hare Krishna, or get a proper job. But, or once they told Ajahn Sumedho, because he was much older, some guy on the way to work, dressed in a suit, went up to him and said, "You're old enough to know better." That was so withering. You have to enjoy all this stuff. But these people were pointing at me and laughing. I didn't know why. And you know what happened in the end? We walked for another 15 minutes, people laughing. I didn't mind causing happiness to people. And then I realized why. And there's this big billboard. Circus in town. They thought I was one of the clowns. Honestly, they thought that way. And then the clown was going for a walk in the morning. I always wanted to be a clown. So anyway, so no self-consciousness. Don't give a damn what other people think of you. You know, actually people aren't thinking of you. They're all thinking of themselves here. So don't worry what you're doing. Just go and do it, for goodness sake. But anyway, if you really are self-consciousness, just go and sit in your room. They've got CCTV cameras in there hidden, so I see everything you're doing. No, I don't. No self-consciousness there. What is the minimum age of children who can attend these retreats? I don't know. Are you talking about emotional age or physical age? Because emotional age is pretty low down. No, it is if a child can actually can meditate quietly and keep peaceful. There's no real age for it. I don't know, what's the youngest person who's ever been on a meditation retreat, Bianca? 17, 18, I think. Oh, with a parent once, yeah. But I don't know if it really worked, because they're to meditate, and nothing else to do. Pretty tough for a child. So basically, whoever can do it. And if they can't, it's not good for them. Does all full awakening to arahatship come via the three knowledges in the same sequences described by the Buddha, are the other alternative routes. That was the Buddha's first awakening, was to pass to past lives, then to the working of karma, and lastly to the full enlightenment. So it's obvious in other places it says you can get enlightened without remembering your past lives. So that is the way, especially if you get enlightened understanding suffering, dukkha. Some people get enlightened by focusing on anatta, non-self, there's no one in here. And other people by focusing on anicca. But sometimes people, anicca is the easy one, but be careful. It's the hardest one, because people assume they know what anicca is, and they don't. Is inner speech arising because we react with what happens in the present moment? Inner speech is just a bad habit. Sometimes that, you know, you're taught in school to describe something, put it into words, and that causes a lot of trouble. The inner speech story, and maybe I'll ask you in a moment after this, inner speech story was something I read from the Tao tradition. Lao Tzu, the great master of Taoism, he had a monastery, and he would go for a walk every evening, and he would allow one of his students to accompany him on the walk. And one evening a new young man was allowed to go on a walk with the master. But there was a golden rule which you had to keep silence when walking with the master. No talking aloud. Just be mindful, be quiet. So they went for a walk through the forest, and they came to a ridge in the mountains at sunset. And there's a glorious sunset over the mountains. And the student was so excited and inspired by the golds and the crimsons streaking over the horizon that he forgot the rule. And he blurted out, "Wow, what a beautiful sunset." At that, Lao Tzu turned around, without saying a word, walked back to the monastery, and then announced that that young man was prohibited for the rest of his life for going on a walk with a master. He'd broken the rule, he'd spoken. And because the punishment was so severe, for the rest of his life? That's a bit harsh. Anyway, what's wrong with saying what a beautiful sunset? And in this story, this is where I understood the difference between this inner commentary and reality. Lao Tzu replied, "When my student said, 'What a beautiful sunset,' he was not watching the sunset anymore. He was only watching the words." You got it, yeah. If you say, "What a beautiful sunset," you're not watching the sunset, you're watching the words. If you label breathing in, you're not watching the breath anymore, you're watching the word. A big difference there. Which is why the inner speech is very deceptive. It's a description, it's not the thing. Or like I kept on saying in Nottamara, not now, you've moved the toilets, but I remember going there one, I think, for a committee meeting, and just from making a point, I asked, "Where is the toilet?" And I knew where it was. I was making a point, a Dhamma teaching. And they pointed out, "See the door over there? It's got toilet written over it. It's over there." So I went to the door and pretended to urinate on the door. "It says toilet." "It says toilet? That's a toilet. That's where you told me to urinate." "It's not, the door is not the toilet, even though it says it on there." And so I asked the nuns, "Please be more precise. Never put on the outside toilet, put on their toilet inside." That is like the label. The label, the sign is not the toilet. It's pointing to something. And urinating on the door when it says toilet is just like believing the label is the thing. So, the inner commentary is not the truth. And just believing in the inner commentary is like urinating on the door when it says toilet. Ladies, men, you urinate on that. Please don't do that. How does one know whether one is feeling sleepy because the body is tired or because of sheer laziness? People in today's world are not lazy. You're highly motivated and you feel so guilty at any hint of laziness. I challenge you to be lazy. It's hardly anyone in this room can actually do that. Try it. See if you can be lazy. Sleep in. Get up for breakfast. After breakfast, go and have a nap until lunch. After lunch, go and have another nap. 3-4 o'clock in the afternoon, get up, have a cup of tea, then go and have another. Be lazy. Can you do that? Oh, you're too proud to be lazy. You're too motivated. Challenge. Try to be lazy. You can't do it. So, you're not. If you're feeling sleepy, it's always the body is tired. It's not laziness. Because you've forgotten the art of being lazy. I did know when I was living in Laos. No, living in northeast Thailand. It's a Laos, basically it is Laos. It's the Thais just, the Thai people just took it over. But it's Laotian culture. Now they are lazy people. I really admire them for their laziness. If there's nothing to do, they do nothing. And in the hot weather you see them sleeping under the shade of their houses and you ask them what they're doing. And they have this Lao word, yusasu, which means just being. Not doing anything, just being. And they never felt guilty about just being. Me, I was told because Christian upbringing, the devil makes work for idle, no, trouble for idle hands or something. Don't be idle and lazy, the devil will get you. So I never knew how to be lazy. These guys did. And I told someone a story about them. There was one of my fellow monks, he was in Laos during the Vietnam War. He lived in Luang Prabang. And he told me the story, they were at war. The communists against the government. And he was in one of these restaurants. You know, anyone who's been to Bali or been to Southeast Asia, bamboo walls, thatched roof, really dirty, no hygiene, but really delicious curries. And so he was sitting there having his lunch, and there was some government soldiers were also having lunch at another table with their M16 machine guns against the wall, just in case, having their lunch during wartime. And he really almost, his heart almost stopped when he saw some of the communist troops, the Pathet Lao, come in. They also came into the restaurant. And he expected gunfire. These were people at war with one another. But the communist soldiers, they just chose another table. Put their guns against the wall. Because in Laos, war stops for lunch. Lunch is more important. You've got to get your priorities right. And they had some gentleman's agreement that after lunch, you know, the government soldiers came in first, so they would go out and go to the left, and the other ones, no, actually the government would go to the right, and the communists go to the left, or something like that. So to make sure they didn't meet each other after lunch, because, you know, the time for digestion to happen. And that was just so true to that type of culture. They didn't take war seriously, they just had to, but just to make sure they didn't meet each other. Now that was actually just laziness. So you try and do that. You're too highly motivated. So if you are tired, if they're sleepy, it's because you're tired. Take a rest. And if you go to bed and you can't go to sleep, it's obvious, you know, it wasn't really tiredness. So just relax. Is there a nimitta in walking or laying down meditation? No, not really. Well, it can be, but if you get a nimitta during walking meditation, you'll walk into the wall. because you see the nimitta, and then you really see stars, a really nice nimitta. Okay. Walking or laying down meditation to reach jhana. Laying down meditation to reach jhana, but not walking meditation. There's quite a few questions, guys. Have you had enough now, or should I carry on for another 10 minutes? Do you want to go to bed? Put your hand up if you had enough. One. Put your hand up if you want more. Okay, very good. Got a few more. Most people didn't pull their hand up at all. It reminds me of this story in the University of New South Wales. They were electing someone to be the president of the students' union, like a democratic election. And one very clever student, he founded the Apathy Party. The Apathy Party. And he hardly got a vote. But he did point out to the authorities that only about 30% of the students voted. So he claimed the other 70% as members of the Apathy Party and claimed victory. This is a good argument there. They didn't buy it, but it's a good argument. I like to teach to be kind and compassionate to my little one, but my partner doesn't believe in these things. Sometimes I feel very unhappy. How can I handle this? If you have a little kid, it does mean that you teach them by example, more than any words. So if you're kind and compassionate, of course, you know, your kid will become kind and compassionate too. And your partner will also become kind and compassionate. So don't teach by words. Teach by example. Ajahn, can you please tell the carrot joke? Do you really want to hear the... Put your hand up if you want to hear the carrot joke. Why do three people, four people? Put your hand up if you're fed up with the carrot joke. Be honest. Okay, you guys win. Sorry. It's a really good joke, though. Oh, what the hell, I'm going to tell it. You know I'm going to tell it. I love this joke. It's really good. Two carrots walking down the road. And one gets hit by a drunk driver. And is badly injured. The other carrot gets on his smartphone, rings 000, calls the ambulance. The ambulance comes really quickly, screeches to a halt. They come out, look at the injured carrot. Serious. So they put him in the gurney, put him into the back of the van, and the other carrot goes in with his friend. They rush to the hospital, into triage. The nurse takes one look, emergency surgery straight away, and the other healthy carrot has to be in the waiting room, not knowing what's going on with his friend. And if ever that's happened to you, I've been in emergency rooms so often, visiting people who are, you know, my disciples who are injured or dying. It's such a tense place. People just waiting for news. They don't know what's going to happen next. It's one of the most tense and anxious places, the waiting room in the emergency department. After 2 hours, the surgeon comes in. And he recognizes, oh, you know, you're the friend of Mr. Carrot, because you're a carrot too. Your friend, I got some good news. Stupid joke. I got some good news and bad news for you. The good news is your friend, Mr. Carrot, he's going to make it. He's going to survive. The bad news is he's had some terrible injuries. Such bad injuries that he's going to be a vegetable for the rest of his life. I don't care if you don't like it. I think that's always funny. He's a vegetable for the rest of his life. That's a sick joke. Anyway. Any vegetarians here? Okay, can I tell you the anti-vegetarian joke? I do make up jokes. How can a vegetarian eat a steak? How can a vegetarian eat a steak and still be a vegetarian? Very simple. You take a cow, and very kindly, under anesthetic, you give the cow the medical procedure called a lobotomy. You take a lot of the cow's brain out. And when the cow wakes up, the cow's a vegetable. So I get hate mail for that joke. They want to give me a lobotomy. I've already had one. No, I haven't. Anyway, is aspiring equal to wanting? Of course it is. Aspiring is equal to wanting. It's just spin to make it sound better. Example, may I be free from danger, etc. May I be free from danger? That's in the future. There's only one way to be free from danger, creating your future right now. So it is wanting. And it's not putting your attention in the right place. Is it okay before meditation we make aspiration? E.g., may today meditation is smooth, or maybe I'll be able to meditate properly. Yeah, sort of, but it's not the best. Instead of that, just make the aspiration when you start meditating. May I have no aspirations. Aspire for that. The end of aspirations. Because we have what I call the four aspirations. The aspiration comes first. That is followed by desperation when it doesn't work. Which is followed by expiration when you leave. There's one other two aspirations. Exasperation, that's right. The four aspirations all start from aspiration. What was the other one? Is desperation. Aspiration when you want something, desperation when it's not working, exasperation when you try everything, you can't do anything, and expiration when you just leave. Go to expiration first of all, that's much, much better. That's the best aspiration. So don't have aspiring, have expiring. Expire, vanish, let wanting just disappear. That's the best aspiration. Okay. I welcome meditation as a break from my mind and its constant worries. Brilliant. However, in real life, real life again. What do you mean, real life? How many of you dye your hair, have boob jobs, use makeup, and go to watch TV? Is that real life? How many of you? I've been to these shopping centres. That is so unreal. You don't live in a real life. Monks do. We don't go to shopping centres. We don't use makeup. I don't dye my hair. This is as you are. This is real. But how much in life people live in a fake world? A world of makeup, a world of wonder bras when I was young, making you look like something you're not. And what's the other one? Plastic surgery. It's not real. It's fake. Shopping centres. It's so fake in there. The lighting is fake. Everything is fake. Fake food. Are you real? Is that the real world where you live? And I say, no, the real world is here, in China Grove. Welcome to the real world. When you go home and go back to the fake world, try to impress people with something you're not, then you understand what I mean. So I like, the real world is this. They all... it's constant worries. Your worries all flood back. I blame myself for hurting others and doing stupid things constantly. You don't do things constantly. Sometimes you hurt other people, sometimes you're kind to people. So, you know, you're not sort of... Don't just see the bad part of yourself. Here, when you meditate, you're peaceful, you're still, you have a break, then you get actually perspective on life. This will be the last question because I'm getting fed up now. One story which I gave years ago was when I was 18, went to the United States, got bored there, so I went to Central America. I went into the jungles in the Yucatan Peninsula to see these ancient ruins from the Mayan civilization. And I went to deep in the jungles, this place called Tikal. And when I went there, it took about 3 or 4 days through the jungle to get there. And when I arrived, there was only one other archaeologist around. So I could go wherever I wanted. You can understand how people stole all the artifacts because no one was there. And I was 18-year-old male. So what does an 18-year-old male do when they see these huge pyramids? Climb them. It's a boy thing. So I decided to climb to the top of this huge pyramid, not really knowing what I was doing, what I would find at the top there. And at the top there was this little room. But that was not what caught my attention. What caught my attention, at the top of that pyramid, it was just above the tree line of the jungle. And I'd been just traveling for 3 or 4 days. I had not seen the horizon for 4 days. Because in the jungle, the roads, everything just grows over it. You didn't even see the sky. You're just going through green tunnels all the time. And that really hit me. For the first time in 4 days, I could see the horizon. Emptiness in all directions with nothing between me and infinity. And when I looked down, I could see the whole jungle laid out before me. This was the days before Google Maps. That's what it was like. Seeing the Google map of the territory, which I'd taken days to travel, all laid out before me. I understood why those jungle pyramids were there. The symbolism of seeing infinity, emptiness, which embraces and connects us all. No one, no priest, no dogma, no religion between you and the infinite. And look down, you can see your world. Once you're out of it, you can understand what it's like. So you come in here, it's like climbing the pyramid. And you look down and you understand the life in which you live. The family, the work, relationships, because you're out of it. You get this beautiful Google map perspective of life. So when you do go back into the jungle, which is your life, you have a much better understanding of how it all works and which way to go. So all those problems and worries of life, after you've meditated and climbed that pyramid, you look back upon it and it's stupid stuff. It's not really a problem after all. You lower your expectations of people. You just love them. When they're really stupid, you love them even more. You don't get hurt by people. It's just people being people. Dogs bark, woof woof, cats go meow, husbands complain, wives spend too much, kids never follow your orders. That's just life. It's like trying to stop a dog barking. It's what dogs do, what people do. So after a while you just let it be. So you don't blame anyone, you just get the full picture. Will continued kindfulness and meditation eventually break this pattern? Guaranteed. Should one try to do other things also? Ah, no, don't try anything. Meditation is not trying. It's relaxing and letting go. You've been trying all your life. So now's the time to stop. And let the carrot come to you. I'm talking about the carrot which was not injured. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Okay, have a wonderful night, or don't have a wonderful night, whatever you want to do. You are free. The other questions I'll try and answer tomorrow.